Welcome to the Out Agenda on archive.kpfk.org. I'm Rita Gonzalez.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh. Rita, let me start out with wishing you a very happy holiday. Here we are.
I know it. It's going to
smack in the middle of it. We got a very good Christmas present this year, I might add.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. So I hope at least, what is it, 81 million are happy.
Yeah. Yes. I guess you're right. That's right. It's not a Christmas present for a large population.
That's right.
For those of us. And you know what, Rita, since we've been going through all this stress with COVID and the election, you know, people are craving something kind of fresh, entertaining, maybe a little humor. And I think we have just the thing for our listeners.
I think so. And we have been, in the last few shows, we have been doing different performances that are happening around town that people can stream, because there is so much going on with COVID, the elections, unemployment. There's a lot of things happening, and we need a little escape. Yep, I don't know about you, but I've been watching a lot of Hallmark movies. I never watched Hallmark.
I've been watching them too.
Because everybody's happy at the end.
Exactly. I was watching one the other day, and my partner was here, and you know, he says, "Why aren't you going to finish watching that?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll finish watching it tomorrow," meaning that I'll pick up another movie tomorrow because they all end exactly the same. So you don't even need to finish the same movie when you're watching Hallmark.
I actually watched one that was a bunch of the actors, because I guess it's everything happens in Evergreen, and there was a bunch of, I guess it was a bunch of Christmas movies with different actors, and they were all in the same one.
Really?
Yeah, just to kick off the year. And I thought, oh my God, I saw that one and that one. They had several of the actors from previous Christmas ones that, you know, for the last couple of months, and they're all in Evergreen. It was a happy ending.
Oh, that's great. You know what? I have to give Hallmark credit, because you know what? They always keep it light. They always keep it, you know, simple, and they always keep it kind of pretty with all the Christmas decorations. And, you know, they had their first gay couple in a Hallmark movie.
Well, one of the gay couple, one of them, I guess, was on this show too, on the Hallmark thing.
Oh, really? The gay couple? Oh, really? Wow.
Well, it wasn't the gay couple. It was just
one of the actors.
Just one of the actors who, what he's, they talked about his partner.
Do we know if they're really gay in real life or not?
I didn't know. I just said, but they just had, several actors, the couples that got together, but they showed maybe one of the couple and not the other one, you know, part of the couple. Mm-hmm. I guess they couldn't pay for everybody. So, but it was like one of the couple that was happily ever after, they showed them on this thing.
Oh.
But so I just thought, oh my God, I've watched this many Christmas shows.
I know. Your brain probably is mushed by now. But you know what? And speaking of which, you know what? If you're looking for something a little more intellectually stimulating, I think we might have just a thing for you.
That's right. We have the play Making Friends.
Yes. It's a one-man show.
Who are our guests?
Our guests are writer and actor. It's a one-man show. Tom Dutrinis and the director, Drew Droege, are going to be on the show to tell us all about it.
Okay, maybe we should ask them if they watch any Hallmark shows.
That's a good question.
I think they were probably very busy doing their own show.
Yes, they were.
Anyway,
although, you know what? They're on 24/7, I think, aren't they?
Hallmark? I think so,
You know what? That's a really good question. For writers, have you ever watched a Hallmark movie?
I also watched The Prom.
Oh, what'd you think of that?
I love musicals. I love things like that. So it was, to me, I loved it.
Really?
I cried.
Oh.
I cried. I thought it was good. I watched that and I watched Dolly Parton musical. I told you, it was on Hallmark.
Oh, that's the Christmas something, Christmas coat, the coat of many colors or something like that?
I don't know. There was just a lot of singing and dancing.
I love Dolly.
I tell you, I'm just watching a lot of happy things right now because I'm trying to stay safe and sane.
Yeah.
And live in my little fantasy world because it's almost over.
Yeah.
Because Well, it's not over yet. We still have months, but people are getting the vaccination now. So I've been watching that. So,
yeah, but I think one of the things that we really need to, at least what I've been hearing, make really clear is that just because there's a vaccine doesn't mean that we're necessarily out of the woods yet. First of all, once you get vaccinated, you can still carry the virus and pass it to other people. So they want people to still wear masks when they go out in public. So it's not like all of a sudden the world is going to open back up again and we're going to be able to run around and hug everybody. Necessarily.
No, you can still get COVID, but I think, and I'm not a doctor, but I think it's like the flu. You can still get the flu, but the symptoms are not as
severe.
They're not as severe, but you still can get it. Yeah. And you still can pass it on to your loved ones. So yes. So we still have to be
careful. And you know what? I think we're a little ways down the line. So hopefully by spring, early summer, we shall all be vaccinated, or most of us will be vaccinated.
And I can see the faces of all my new friends because I have no idea who anybody is.
It'll be nice to see our friends again, don't you think?
That's introduced, I guess.
All right. Drew Droege and Tom Detrinis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
We have a lot to talk about, but I think Ralph's going to ask you first a little bit about a little bit about your background.
Tom, let's start with you. You're a writer, director, producer, actor. How did you get involved in this business? And then we'll go into talking to a little bit about the performance.
Oh, sure. I think I was 8 years old when my father was forcing me to go to basketball, practice. And he paid for like a private league. And I would come home crying every day. And my dad was like, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "I hate it." And then he said, "Okay, well, if you keep going, I'll also pay for your acting classes." And I was like, "Okay, done." And so that is really how I bit the bug, was a long, long time ago when my dad made a deal with me. He made deals even when I was 8. You know what I mean? And so it all began there. And then I did community theater at where I lived. And then I went to school for musical theater. And then I came out here and I was working in an office for a long time in an agency. And then I started doing some theater out here. And that's kind of like how I got involved in the theater scene here in LA, originally with my own little theater company called 30 Minute Musicals. Then I got very involved at the Celebration. Then I got very involved at the I Am a Theater Company. So it kind of just got all the way to this point. And along the way, Drew and I have worked on many a show, play, musical, lots of things in the past. So that's kind of how, that's the short answer.
Where are you from?
Long Island originally. And then I went to school in Buffalo and then I came here. So that's kind of how I have gotten involved in this crazy business.
When I read your bio and it talked a lot about a little bit about your family and how big your family is, you must have been somewhat performing when you, ever since you were very young.
I think I came out of the womb performing just constantly. I've always been very, very loud and obnoxious and doing some kind of version of theater. I think the first theater piece I ever saw ever was my cousin's high school production of 42nd Street. And I must have been like 6 years old at the time. And I remember leaving that theater just like, what is this? Like, all I did was think about it. All I did was think. So I think that it has always been inside of me, you know, and it just, my parents just kind of like gently opened the door and I like slammed it all the way and was like, "It's here. I'm here."
With 30 first cousins, is anyone else in your family gay? I'm just curious.
No. I don't have any queer brethren to share stories with. It's just me sitting alone at a party, you know, just at Christmas, just crying.
Now, if this is a one-person show?
Yes, it is a one-person show. Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about the show. What was the idea and how was it born and how did it grow?
It grew from my storytelling. So I always have a story to tell, and Drew can attest to that, and something crazy that has happened to me or something interesting. And it all began with just writing down my own personal stories. And I did that initially to try and find a through line between all of the stories and this ones that are really funny and the ones that are very touching. And then through various iterations of writing the show, it came to this point where I am kind of telling my own personal tale. It's, and Drew said this earlier today, and I loved it. It's kind of like a coming out tale, a coming out about my anger, a coming about out about my family story, a coming out about me as who I actually am as a person. And I think that that is really what the show is about. It kind of explores gayness, it explores anger, it explores family, it kind of like touches on all of that that make me up to be whatever this is.
Now, I have to ask Drew here, because you are the director of this performance. Now, is it challenging when the performer is also the writer?
It is. It's a blessing and a curse in a way, because the greatest thing is with a new piece, the first part of the process is just really working on the writing before we get into any of the performance. It's like, what are we saying here? We've got to move this around there. And I'm also a writer, so it was a great way that we could sort of meet our minds and sort of say, like, how can we make this and punch this up and all of that. So the great thing is that we're not doing the Glass Menagerie and we just have to say the words that Tennessee Williams wrote. We can do I have the writer in front of me and we can work things and change them. And it's tough in another way too, because you have to realize, as a director, like when to back off and when to let the writer tell the story and not to put my own stamp on it too much and not to try to, make me the writer as much as let Tom be the writer and encourage that. So, but I love it. I mean, for the collaborative process that I like, I only like to direct projects where I'm really passionate about the work. I mean, as an actor, I'll take anything that pays the bills. I mean, I really am. It's a lot to sort of sign on to take hold of a piece. And I just was so happy when Tom asked me. Tom also directed me in my solo show last year. So we've worked together a lot as actors. And this is the first time, and Tom's directed me several times, but this is the first time that I've directed Tom. So it was great to get to, have the power this time.
Drew, yes. What was it like to do it virtually? Actually, that's for both of you, but let's start with you, Drew.
It was definitely a challenge. First of all, Tom's never done the show in front of an audience before. And we did it in rehearsal. And so the most people that saw this at one time was about five, producers, our stage manager, designers, and whatever. So we had to wing it and sort of imagine what we think is going to work. And I had, we had to really trust our taste and our instincts and kind of say, I think this is, a funny moment here. I think this is a touching moment here. I believe in this moment. So we didn't have the benefit of having an audience there. And the other way, we had power in that because we were able to just say, it's going to be what it's going to be. And we're going to put it up in that way. And it was great to go back to a theater. And we filmed it in a theater and just walking in and, 2020, those of us that know and love to do theater and to watch theater, it was just so nice to get to go back into that space and work there.
And you, Tom? Oh. No, I was going to say, Tom, you answered that question.
Everything that Drew said, I think that there was so many positives about doing it this way. There's also just a few negatives in that we don't get the love of the audience. I mean, that's kind of like a negative, but also, we have to be safe at this time and it's important to put that into our brains as much as we wanted an audience. Cause when we chatted about what is this going to look like inside the theater when we film it, some of the conversation was a long time ago was, will there be people in the theater? Are we going to put people in there to watch the show as we're doing it? Or is it going to be a bare audience? And then that obviously had to be thrown out the window just because you can't do that because everyone would have to get a COVID test. It'd be a nightmare actually. But I think it was just, it's hard to perform to an empty space when you know it's theater, when it was very challenging when we first started filming it to kind of get over that, to like not get the call and response that a performer gets from the audience. Even from the rehearsal audience, because that's still an audience. And it was a challenge, but I think we did a great job. I think that people are really going to feel, they're going to feel like they're in the theater. They're going to feel like they are with us there and they're going to get the theatricality of the piece, and mostly because I'm incredibly animated. So it's not, although there are small touching moments, there's also very big, loud, boisterous, energetic moments in there too.
Okay. I have to ask you now, when you did the play. Now you've done television too. Are you using different camera angles on this?
Yes, there are a bunch of different angles. Drew, you can kind of explain.
Well, we had three cameras on this, and we did two full runs of the show, and we moved the cameras. So we had really like six different options to choose from, and that, you know, and so just sort of putting it all together. And then the trick in this is to like edit it together so that you don't notice that it's edited and make it feel like you're there in the room. So it's a tricky hybrid of theater and film, you know, when you're like, you're not really making a movie where you're cutting every line and trying to make it all perfect. It's messy and live and like theater, but it also, we wanted it to feel polished and get Tom at his best angles and his best performances. So, yeah.
Tom, I'm kind of wondering about, so you're actually performing your life. What's that like to do that on stage? Do you feel really vulnerable and not really having an audience? You don't know, did people think, you know, things that were supposed to be funny were funny? I mean, is it, must be a challenging.
Oh, it's very tricky because, Drew and I had to trust that things were definitely funny. And I think in those rehearsals, when some people were listening, things got funnier because we found better choices in the moment because people were laughing. And that kind of developed the humor even more. What was that first question?
I was curious about how vulnerable you felt up on stage performing your life.
Oh, of course, my brain forgot about that question. It was very difficult because I had to make the decision in writing the show that I was going to be myself. And for the first few drafts of this show, I was not myself. I was a character that was telling my personal stories through their lens. And I had to, and it just wasn't clicking. And the only thing that made it click was being myself. And I realized, you know, the people who know me incredibly well. And they know a lot of these stories and they know a lot of my inner, like, you know, whatever, but the general public doesn't know anything about me and they haven't seen me enough to know all of that. So this is really, like Drew said, is kind of a coming out in many different ways. And in response to what you're saying, I had to be vulnerable for you all to get to know me. It's that kind of coming out of like, who is this person? Who is this artist? It's kind of a little bit of that story, you know. It was very hard to tell those tales, but through the process of constantly revising and rehearsing it, it became easier because it wasn't so scary. I think I'm very excited to do this for a live audience eventually, because I think those moments are really going to elevate because I'll have those human beings there watching me. And that's really going to, that energy exchange is really going to, I don't know what create what inside of me, but it will. Cause it already was at times very, very, it was never hard, but it was, it felt different inside of me.
Now, since this is going to be online, have you invited your family to watch this?
Oh, yes, I have. Yeah. My mom and dad are very excited to watch, and my siblings are very excited to watch. I know some of my cousins are excited to watch. I don't know about the rest of them. They don't like cursing. They don't like sex talk. And a lot of this is all of that. There's a lot of sex talk, a lot of cursing, because that's just who I am. So if I have already warned my own parents, like, I'm going to talk a lot about these things and you're going to have to just shoulder on, because you're going to find out a lot of information you probably didn't want to know.
Do you talk about your parents at all?
Very briefly, because the story really isn't about their relationship with me. It's more about my extended family and their relationship and the effect that they had on me. So my parents are very supportive. Drew's met them many times. They've come to several of Drew's shows in New York. They are very, they just love seeing theater. They love going out and having a good time. So I think they're going to enjoy it. I think they're going to learn something.
Drew, so you know Tom, you've known him for years. That must make directing him easier or more challenging?
I would definitely say easier for the most part, because we've done so many different things together. So we do speak a shorthand, and we are both able to kind of talk like, well, you know, it's just kind of like bit, lit, lit. And then it's like, we know what that means. So, and then it's about communicating that to other people. We realize we get into meetings and we're like, oh, right, we have to kind of explain more in that way. So, but I will say, as long as I've known Tom, like, you know, we've done a lot. I did not know Tom on this level. And I don't, I think very few people do. I think the Tom that most people meet, he is full of joy and he's life of the party and he's so much fun. And, you know, but the inner workings, I mean, I always knew that he was angry a lot because I am too. And we have that in common. We kind of, we love to get together and just like, you know, have a total session of screaming. But there were layers that I didn't know. And there was so much about him that I was like, wow, about his family and about how, you know, and so we got to find that together in building the show. So I'm so excited for people to see it because people who know and love Tom don't know this Tom and don't know the depth of it. So for me as a director, a lot of it too, I've directed a lot of solo shows and I just learned mainly to get out of their way and to make them look the best possible. And it's not about my vision as a director or how I see it. It's really about the person. And so in this case, it was like, how do we make Tom the best? And so for that, it was great. And I can't imagine sort of going into a situation like this. It's so intimate directing a solo show. If you don't know the person well, it's almost a bad idea to pick a director that you don't know for your own solo show. I think that's a
what's
that's
easier, a multi-cast play or a one-man show, one-woman show, one-person show?
So different. I mean, I love, you know, when you get to do a play and you have like this family and you're telling a story and you have a set and you have all these elements that, you know, but what's amazing about doing a solo show is that you can, all that gets stripped away. You have a focus on one person and you can really, really get in there. Also, you know, in quarantine COVID times, like we're able to like, you know, sort of self quarantine and then we can sort of we can see each other, you know, it's so much easier. Like, so I'm grateful that we have been able to do this. We couldn't have done a play and just made everybody locked down and, you know, there would have been no way. So
it would have been really challenging. Yeah. I think that was one of the, it also made this such a fun process because the world wasn't coming in on our rehearsal process besides the election and those kind of things. But like work things were actually very easy. Auditions for Drew that would come in. It didn't really distract from like, you know, we both didn't have to drive all over the city all of the time to get to all of these things. Like we could very easily find time to like work with each other, which made it incredibly easy and also very fun because it was lovely to feel like we were in a rehearsal process and working on theater when we really haven't been able to do that for such a long time. So with a bigger cast, this would have been, it would have been impossible. It would have just been on Zoom and been one of those other Zoom things that we've done and blah, 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 and whatever. But this is definitely, I think, we were very fortunate at this time, even though it's a terrible, what we're going through in this world is just abysmal, but it was a bright spot. Really,
this play is started on December 17th, which is like during the holiday season, which we're going through the political challenges right now. And then we have 2020, which is, I hope it's gone. I'm glad it's going to be gone soon.
Yeah.
Is that all inclusive in your play too? Or is it just basically you and your challenges as a gay man growing up?
I think it's, I didn't include anything political in the play or the piece or anything about the quarantine on purpose because I just think that we have had enough of it. And if I brought that into the piece, I think it would just kind of dumb it down the message a little bit. And so I don't bring up the president or the next president. I bring up none of that. I bring up no political fights that I've had with my family at all. That's really not what this conversation is about. And I also didn't really, you know, I didn't want to make it about like, oh, here we are in quarantine. I just didn't feel like that was necessary because like we already are, we're in it. Like it would be nice. And I wanted this to be an escape, a retrospective escape for the audience so that they could disappear for their lives for an hour and just let me barf words out at them. And then, I mean, hopefully they will feel something from it. And I think Drew really helped a lot with the structure of the piece and really helped make it flow and turn it into a story, like an overarching story and then little stories. And it really takes you on a journey, I think, now because Drew really was really watching that. And that's what a lot of the process in the beginning was, more than performance, was is this making sense? How do these pieces fit together? What does it sound out like out? What does it sound like out loud? And how does it all connect with each other?
And also, I will say, anytime you do queer anything, you are being political on that level. You know, and you are, I mean, to make something, and also for gay people to be able to come out about their anger and about not trying so hard to make people like them and just to be real, you know? And so I think there's that message in this as well, which definitely shines through.
Oh, great. So give us the information. How can we see this play?
You go to iamatheater.com and you just click the link to buy tickets, and then it's going to send you to a site. The tickets are $15 or more. The more is really so you can donate to the theater, which has been working very hard during this time and has many other solo plays coming up, which is so great. You buy your ticket for a weekend, and once you press play, you have 48 hours to watch it. But so you have some time in case, like, you are watching and then you have to go do something or what have you. You can break it up if you want. And each ticket also comes with a talk back. The first weekend is Michael Urie, and the second weekend is Byron Lane and Tom Lank, both of which Drew and I have worked with numerous times and who we both respect as well. So there's in the other 2 weeks after that, we'll have special guests as well that people will get, like, kind of a complimentary little treat that they can watch, where we dissect the show and we talk about it and kind of, like, go through it. And so there's, like, a little bit of bonus material that you get with each week of purchasing a ticket.
Now, this is streaming until January 11th. Now, When it's streaming, it's not like certain days. So I can see it anytime between the 17th of December and January 11th.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's not like Monday, Friday, or, you know, how I'm used to theater, you know, you see it on a Thursday.
You have it for a week, right? I mean, once it starts, you have 48 hours, but you can buy it and you have a week to watch.
I do want to address that, Tom. I'm sure that you prefer that people watch the performance all at one time. It's nice that you can extend it over a couple days or a week if you want to, but it kind of impacts the performance. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, I'm sure it would. I mean, I'm not going to be offended if someone told me that they did that, though, ever.
But it's 65 minutes long. So, I mean, it's an hour, you know, so it's and it flies by. I've seen it. I promise everybody. I've seen it 400 times.
Could you be a stand-in, Drew, if you needed to be?
pretty much as well as he does.
Well, you gave us all the information. Once again, we can see it by going to
iamatheater.com. Or just Google iamatheater. Yes.
Making friends. And then it will also be on our website on KPFK, so people can get more information on that. It'll also be on our Twitter. So we can watch it. I'm looking forward to seeing it. So I can see it in the comfort of my home. I can even have my little jammies on, and it's 65 minutes. And
That's the whole point. That's the joy.
Excellent.
That's
the ease. You know, Tom, I just wanted to ask you really quickly before we have to go. Is there anything, without revealing the subject matter necessarily, but is there anything that you were kind of hesitant to put in at all, where you thought, oh, I don't know?
I was hesitant about all of the sex talk, and one family story I was hesitant about putting in. It's a very intense story, and I even had to speak to my family about it a little bit. I had to make sure the story was about me and not the person I'm telling the story about. I was that, and I still kind of sit here wondering if it was the best choice, honestly. But we'll see how people respond to it. But those are the two things. The sex thing, mostly just because of my family watching. But this other story more so is like, it, you know, it's a very challenging tale to tell. Yes, all of the names are changed except, I think, for my mom's name. I say Diane one time. I think she's the only one I kept in.
I hope they have a different last name than you. So
my last name is incredibly specific. So that's why I really did have to change a lot of the names so no one would ever catch on.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us here at The Out Agenda.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you.
And once again, our guests have been director Drew Droege and actor, writer Tom Dutrinis. And we want to hear from you. So please tell us what you think of The Out Agenda and about the kinds of interviews and stories you'd like to hear.
Follow us on Twitter or email us at theoutagenda@gmail.com. I'm Rita Gonzalez.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh. Thanks for listening and have a wonderful week.
And remember that being out is the first step to being equal. Now stay tuned for This Way Out. Everyone have a very safe and great holiday season.
There was a whole history that was pretty obscure, and it was a very important part of the women's movement of the 60s, 70s, and 80s and after. And it was time to put some light on it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Bhutan decriminalizes same-gender sex, Bolivia creates free unions for queer couples, and life behind the music at Olivia Records. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Melanie Keller.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending December 12, 2020. The Kingdom of Bhutan is the latest country on the planet to decriminalize same-gender sex. The criminal code has punished sodomy or any other sexual conduct that is against the order of nature with up to a year in prison. According to Pink News, there have been no known prosecutions under those laws. A December 10th joint meeting of the Lower National Assembly and Upper National Council voted to repeal those provisions. None of the 63 members opposed and 6 abstained. The changes await the formal approval of Bhutan's King Jigme Khesar Namgyel Wangchuck. Finance Minister Namjay Cherring was among the government leaders to support the repeal. He said, "To keep up with the times." Bhutan's most invisible, fledgling LGBTQ rights movement lobbied for more than a year for passage of the sex law reform. Tashi Chenten of the queer advocacy group Rainbow Bhutan told Reuters that the bill being passed on Human Rights Day itself is a momentous day for everyone in Bhutan. Dwarfed by its neighbors China and India, the tiny, mostly Buddhist Himalayan nation is home to about 800,000 people.
Veteran gay activist Roy Tan is challenging Singapore's Section 377A again. That penal code provision criminalizes consensual adult same-gender sex. Offenders are punished with up to 2 years in prison. The 62-year-old retired doctor, also known as Tan Sang Kee, was part of an earlier challenge that focused on constitutional rights. The High Court rejected that effort, which is being challenged in the Court of Appeal. Tan's current petition to the High Court argues that enforcement of the statute has been rare and sometimes arbitrary. He claims that inconsistencies in enforcement of the law require its repeal, an approach, he says, has rarely been tried before. Well-known human rights activist M. Robbie is Tan's attorney. Robbie called the inconsistent enforcement of the Asian city state's law problematic. The government has already acknowledged that 377A should not be proactively enforced because it is deemed discriminatory. We know that they cannot go back. The only way is to repeal 377A completely. Tan says he expects the High Court to hear his new lawsuit in about 10 months, but he'll withdraw it if his prior challenge at the Court of Appeal is successful.
Bolivia is the latest member of the Organization of American States to give some form of legal recognition to same-gender couples. According to the news site opinion.com.bo, the December 9th move creates free unions for lesbian and gay couples. The action is intended to bring the country into compliance with a January 2018 ruling by the organization's judicial branch, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. That decision required all member nations that had not already done so to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. While it's not called marriage, free unions reportedly provide those couples with all the rights and privileges of civil marriage, and officials believe it satisfies the Inter-American Court ruling. The legal battle for equality was launched in October 2018 by business administrator David Victor Arequipa Perez and lawyer Guido Alvaro Montaño Duran. Now in their mid-40s, David and Guido have been together since 2008.
a civic registry resolution named them the first same-gender couple, to have the registration of the free union. Lawyers from the Rights in Action Collective celebrated the couple on Twitter, saying that it has been an honor to represent them. Hashtag love is love.
Marriage equality has come to yet another state in Mexico. The news site LaPoliticaOnline.com reported that Congress in the state of Tlaxcala approved a bill opening the civil institution to same-gender couples on December 8th. The vote was 16 in favor and 3 against. A two-hour debate preceded the vote to amend several articles of the civil code. The wording of the rationale for the reforms is rather unique. To guarantee equality and eradicate discrimination by recognizing marriage as the union between two people who are not necessarily male and female. Opposition lawmakers objected to the measure. They claimed that it contravened the essence of the core of society, the family. Apparently, the millions of queer families around the world escaped their radar, families with and without children. Even though a ruling by Mexico's highest court said that same-gender couples should be able to legally marry, the 31 states each had to figure out how to get there. The federal capital of Mexico City is its own jurisdiction and opened civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples first. 19 states have since followed that lead, either through legislation, judicial decisions, or by administrative actions.
Transgender people won 2 cases in U.S. federal courts this week. The Supreme Court refused to consider an appeal of lower court rulings that affirmed an Oregon school district's policy allowing trans students to use gender-appropriate campus facilities. The plaintiff parents argued that trans students should be forced to use facilities based on their assigned gender at birth. Their offensive reasoning was that other students reported embarrassment, humiliation, anxiety, intimidation, fear, apprehension, and stress produced by having to use these privacy facilities with a classmate of the opposite sex. The case was a reaction to what happened in Dallas, Oregon, a predominantly agricultural town about 15 miles west of Salem. Dallas High School student Elliot Yodar came out as trans in 2015 and complained that he was being forced to use the wrong bathrooms and locker rooms on campus. District officials responded by simply issuing a policy to allow trans students to use the facility in which they are most comfortable. The ACLU's Deputy Director for Trans Justice, Chase Strangio, applauded the High Court's refusal to hear the appeal. He said that it had once again said that transgender youth are not a threat to other students. Similar lawsuits have failed in other parts of the country. Some of them cited freedom of religion. The Supreme Court declined to hear one appeal from Pennsylvania last year.
A U.S. federal judge ruled this week that the U.S. State Department should not have required a Nevada trans man to provide a doctor's note before it would issue a passport to him with a male gender marker. Oliver Bruce Morris simply wanted a second form of ID to complement his driver's license. The Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles identifies him as male, but the State Department demanded certification of his completed gender transition. Federal District Court Judge Gloria M. Navarro called the State Department's doctor's note requirement an unconstitutional violation of Morris's Fifth Amendment rights to equal protection. She admonished the department, writing that it has provided no explanation, let alone any evidence, of why it has an important interest in verifying a transgender passport applicant's gender identity. Navarro also noted that not all transgender persons receive or require physician treatment. When he filed the lawsuit in 2019, 25-year-old Morris told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that maybe my family will see it and have a better understanding and see how personal this all is for me. That I'm a person, that I'm a human, that I'm myself, that I'm Oliver.
Finally, 2 drag queen story time participants in Brisbane, Australia, are suing the former leader of the Australian Christian Lobby for defamation. Johnny Valkyrie performs as Queenie, and Dwayne Hill is Diamond at Storytime events and Diamond Goodrem in adult appearances. Both hold valid working with children clearances. A known anti-queer activist committed suicide following a small protest of a Storytime hosted by the Brisbane City Council Library. Former Australian Christian Lobby leader and leading national homophobe Lyle Shelton took advantage of the situation. Shelton called the popular Drag Queens Reading to Kids event the equivalent of harboring sexual predators and pedophiles. Shelton asked his followers, "Have we learned nothing from creeps like Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, and Prince Andrew?" In blog posts, Shelton claimed that the events are dangerous and that drag queens and what they represent are not for kids and they should not be provided a placed in front of children in public libraries. Drag queens Valkyrie and Hill are charging in their lawsuit that Shelton's statements incite hatred towards, serious contempt for, or serious ridicule of the complainants. Valkyrie is also trans, and Shelton specifically claims that makes him especially dangerous. The drag duo is suing Shelton for $10,000 in damages and a public apology. Shelton claims that drag queen story time is an effort to indoctrinate children, and that the lawsuit is simply a demand for him to be gagged.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending December 12th, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is recording remotely during the COVID-19 emergency. It's written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio channel on YouTube. For This Way Out, I'm Melanie Keller. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Lebeau. Stay safe.
From the Furies Collective's publication of one of the world's first lesbian feminist newspapers to the explosion of women's media in the 70s and 80s, Ginny Z. Burson has been a visionary pioneer. Her new memoir about that historic era is called Olivia on the Record, a radical experiment in women's music. Producer Brian DeShazer arranged a conversation between Burson and Olivia Records official archivist Dr. Bonnie Morris. With more on the book and the times, here's This Way Out's Paula Thomas.
Before we hear from our esteemed guests, this is what Aunt Loot Books writes about Olivia Records. The burgeoning lesbian and feminist movements of the 70s and 80s created an impetus to form more independent and equitable social and cultural institutions, bookstores, publishers, health clinics, and more, to support the unprecedented surge in women's arts of all kinds. Olivia Records was at the forefront of these models, not only recording and distributing women's music, but also creating important new social spaces for previously isolated women and lesbians through concerts and festivals.
My family claims the right to know what's wrong with me. They say I'm not turning out the way the men meant to be. My mother's given up my marriage. My father's given up his son. The Holy One is way a woman loving women when it's said and done. Cause we're woman loving women. Sing it loud along.
Good morning, Ginny. It's an honor and a pleasure to be in conversation with you about your magnificent new book, Olivia on the Record. When did you decide that you wanted to write this important historical memoir?
I think it was sometime around 2015. I was invited to be on a panel with Judy Gron and Kalita Reed. Kalita was one of the founders of Diana Press, and Judy, of course, is a great poet and author and was one of the founders of the Oakland Women's Press Collective. And the three of us were on a panel at Mills College, creating a women's revolution in the 1970s. And it became clear to me after doing this panel, or while we were doing this panel, that two things. One was that there was really a lot of interest in what we had done in the 70s among young women and men. And two, that their idea of what happened, the women's movement and what women's liberation and what the lesbian feminist movements were about was a very limited view, that there was a whole history that was pretty obscure. And it was a very important part of the women's movement of the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s and after. And it was time to put some light on it.
And in trying to reconstruct much of the early years of Olivia and your own experience in the Furies Collective and the background of both the women's liberation movement and lesbian feminism. Did you go back to journals you had kept at the time, scrapbooks, or did you begin with your most powerful memories and kind of spiral out from there?
I kept no journals, but I kept a lot of papers. But actually, the way I started writing was from my own memories, from the significant events that I felt put me on the path to starting Olivia. And then I went into my papers and you know, started talking to other women who, some of the other Olivia women and other women who were around Olivia at the time to fill in a lot of the blanks. And of course, there were a lot of blanks because, you know, this was 50 years ago that we started it. So some memories were dim. But I did start, the very first piece that I wrote actually was how I how I got involved with Meg Christian. And that meeting and that relationship was really the foundation originally for Olivia Records. And that was very clear in my mind, that whole scene.
She was a big tough woman, the first to come along, that showed me being female meant you still could be strong. And though graduation meant that we had to part, she'll always be a player on the ball. Etched it on my locker and I carved it on my desk. And I painted big red hearts with her initials on my books. And I never knew till later why I got those funny looks. She was a big tough woman, the first to come along, that showed me being female but just still could be strong.
I think one of the things you do very well is you reconstruct so many conversations, and that's an important part of making the history come alive. I think a lot of people aren't aware of how much of it plays out against the backdrop of activism in DC, and that the Furies House has been made a national historic landmark by, you know, the Park Service or the initiative that recognizes locations that are important to LGBT history. And it was the first that was made a historic site specific to lesbian lives. Did you have a specific vision for what you wanted the book to communicate?
I did. First, I really want there to be this part of the lesbian feminist movement that is really not well known, and that I want people to know about it. I want people to know what we did because, you know, lesbians and radical lesbian feminists were in the forefront of a lot of change and were in the forefront of creating all kinds of institutions that reflected our values and tried to serve our community. And what we did was important, and it is really overlooked. I wanted to look at what we did, both in the Furies, but mostly in Olivia, from the perspective of what it was like in the moment, but also I'm now, you know, 40 years older, and I've learned a lot, and I've done a lot, and I want to bring that consciousness to examine what we did and to look at where we succeeded and where we failed, and to try to pass on some information to this incredibly dynamic and powerful younger generation of really, honestly, mostly lesbians and mostly lesbians of color who are in the forefront of so much of what's political activism now.
It's very rarely, you know, brought out that the, you know, founders of Black Lives Matter are, you know, young Black lesbians, and that aspect is often buried. What would be called intersectionality often buries the lesbian identity. And I love that you're building a bridge across generations in that way.
What we were doing was trying to build the world that we wanted to live in.
Listening to Bonnie Morris, PhD, author of The Feminist Revolution, and social justice activist, author Jeannie Z. Burson, about her book, Olivia on the Record, a radical experiment in women's music, published by Aunt Lute Books. We'll be right back.
The very real issue is touch starvation.
What kind of country do we want to
be? I
want
to be in a parade.
I arrived here during the Cold War from the Soviet Union.
This is evidence not going to end well.
Police sirens wailing. Get on the ground.
I campaigned for the presidency.
A lot of Polish activists fear that Poland is going into the same direction as Russia has been going.
Amy Coney Barrett.
Ready to say goodbye to this whirlwind year? Come join our 2020 TGIO party at thiswayout.org. Check out the queer highlights and lowlights, and look for the light at the end of this turbulent tunnel. A toast to our family of supporters at thiswayout.org.
Baby, have I got a ball gown to show you.
And now back to Jeannie and Bonnie.
I think when you mentioned just before building institutions and services, obviously, for those who are listening, we're talking about the development of Olivia Records, which was in so many ways a product in that albums were produced and there were also concerts and a performance culture that was developed. And I think in looking at the early years of Olivia, you write very well about the complicated economic and class aspects. How is this music going to reach women? Should artists be paid? Should the collective live collectively in terms of whatever money comes in? What does it cost to produce an album? What's the value of women's labor? Should there be a charge for tickets? Should there be sliding scale? And the agonizing hours of processing that went into all of that is part of what you just mentioned, trying to construct an economic system that was woman identified and that acknowledged the inequities in society.
That was a very important part of what we were doing. And, you know, beyond the music and beyond the performance culture, and beyond the community building, what was a big part of the vision of Olivia was that we were going to create, we were going to have our own studio, we were going to have our own pressing plant. This was, of course, at a time when records were pressed into vinyl. We were going to have our own jacket fabrication plant. In other words, we were going to control all the means of production. And everybody that worked at Olivia was every woman who worked at Olivia, and that's what we saw, that's who we saw working there, was going to be well paid, treated well, have an opportunity to learn new skills, have an opportunity to become part of the decision-making collective, and we called this feminism. And our expectation was that when women realized, oh, this is feminism, it's not what the media says feminism is, this is feminism. Feminism means having access and training and
being respected and being paid well and working in a challenging, intellectually challenging and friendly environment. This is feminism? Okay, then I'm a feminist. And unfortunately, we didn't get there. There was this explosion of creativity. There was this because that's what liberation. I mean, we were being liberated. We were in the process of liberating ourselves, and so not only were we creating, not only did we have all this energy for the record companies and the coffee houses and the bookstores and the presses and all the other things that we were creating, but we had tremendous sexual energy also. That was free at last, really. And so, there was a lot of sex and there were a lot of relationships and there was a lot of a lot of great times, and there was a lot of unconsciousness about how to do this, because we wanted to do everything differently than what we had been told was the proper way to do things.
I think that you did a tremendous job in constructing awareness of real people who were doing something extraordinary with, of course, normal human feelings, but a sense of obligation to go beyond the personal into the political.
You know, there were some hard things. All of it was hard, and all of it was wonderful at the same time.
You can find Jenny's book, Olivia on the Record, A Radical Experiment in Women's Music, online at antlute.com. That's AntLute.com. We invite you to listen to the extended interview and our Olivia Records playlist at thiswayout.org. This was produced by Brian DeShazer and engineered by Rebecca Drapkin. I'm Paula Thomas for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Melanie Keller and Michael LeBeau, produced by Brian DeShazer, from Paula Thomas and Bonnie Morris, also produced by Brian DeShazer, and from Lucia Chappelle. Thanks also to Rebecca Drapkin, Teresa Troll, Meg Christian, Chris Williamson, BBK Roche, and Gwen Avery performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, a bequest from Christopher David Trentum, and donors Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WRFZ Rochester, New York, 3ECB Croydon, Victoria, Chiampa Radio, Tampa, Florida, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned.